Hello, I'm Adam Jones. This is number 0255, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0255. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Yogi Akal, who had the special honor of being the first Sikh minister to preside over a gay marriage. He was part of that mass wedding involving 115 couples in Toronto for World Gay Pride Week.
Each of the interfaith ministers gave a short blessing before the individual ceremony. And when I stood up to speak, I said, well, there are no Sikhs being married here today, but history is being made because a Sikh is officiating for the first time at same-sex weddings. And I'm not doing one, but 12. And there was a spontaneous applause. And I was, again, very moved by this because people weren't applauding me. They were just applauding progress. And it was really wonderful to have that spontaneous outpouring of support for that.
Actor Johnny Canizzaro, who is one of the stars of the new musical Jersey Boys, directed by Clint Eastwood.
I had auditioned for the film over a year and a half ago, and that was before Clint, Mr. Eastwood, rather, I should say, had signed on for it. It was being directed by Jon Favreau at that time. And I went in, I had a great audition with the casting director, and then the film got put into turnaround. So then when Mr. Eastwood picked it up, they had kept my tape, called me back in. I auditioned for several roles before finally being offered the role of Nick DeVito.
Author Russell Brooks, whose new spy novel, the third in a series, is called The Demeter Code.
I knew that there was going to be a sequel after having written Pandora's Succession. I honestly didn't know how many books would come out, but I knew that it would be a series. Demeter is the goddess of the harvest, and it's just a way of branding the series so that it could be identifiable, like Pandora's Succession, and now you have The Demeter Code. That's basically where it comes into play. When you read the book, you'll understand why I've used the name of a Greek deity in this case here.
And of course, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0255, was Adam Jones. He's a TV director, the director of the Global Halifax Morning News, and he also has a business that trains dogs in Edmonton. It makes them street smart. You can check out his website for the dogs at 906dogs.ca. That's 906dogs.ca. And thank you very much, Adam, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? How much cash do you think you can cram into your butt? I'm seriously, it's the question I'm asking. $50? Maybe $100? What if you were really motivated? Like it was your entire cachet and it was about to be confiscated by the cops. Let's talk about Tyrone Booker, shall we? 30-year-old Booker was arrested during a drug sting in Jacksonville, Florida. According to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, Booker was placed in the backseat of a cruiser. An officer observed about $300 in the suspect's wallet. The officer then walked away. When the officer returned, the money was missing. Booker said an undercover officer took the money. Officers searched the vehicle, but the money wasn't found. Once at the jail, the arresting officer then looked at the footage from the camera in the cruiser. The video showed Booker spitting on his hands to lubricate his fingers and repeatedly putting his hands in the back of his pants. Now, officers then performed a strip search and found nothing. The suspect finally revealed his hiding spot when he found out the next stop was a trip to the emergency room. The money was rolled up and wrapped in a rubber band inside his rectum. Yes, and due to the money being covered in what the sheriff's office euphemistically called a biohazard, it was not counted and the funds could not be verified. Booker is facing charges of resisting an officer, introducing or smuggling contraband into a detention facility, tampering with evidence, and selling marijuana. Wow. If he's selling drugs, I don't want to know how he makes change. And talk about getting a little behind in your cash flow. Or is that the other way around? Anyway, artist Dimut Strieb offered his 3D printed recreation of the famous ear of Vincent van Gogh for display in June and July in a museum in Karlsruhe, Germany, having built it partially with jeans from a great-great-grandnephew of Van Gogh and in the same shape based on computer imaging technology. Van Gogh, as you may recall, reputedly cut off his own ear back in 1888 during a psychotic episode. Anyway, visitors can also speak into the ear and listen to sounds it receives. Okay. Is there anybody out there who finds this just a tad weird? I mean, seriously, wow. Moving right along, 18-year-old Luke Brown called the police to report a bomb in a food court. That's the food court at Castle Mall in Norwich, Norfolk, England. A bomb sweep was made, no bombs were found, and nobody was evacuated. Police determined that the threat was a hoax and quickly found Brown in the same phone booth where he had made the call. What he was hanging around in the phone booth for, I have no idea, but anyway. Brown confessed to the hoax, saying that he was hoping to help his brother, who worked in the mall, by getting him off work early. Brown's lawyer said his client suffers from learning difficulties and ADHD. Brown had pleaded guilty and had been, quote, a stupid boy, unquote. That's his own words. That's what he told the judge. It's a childish, immature prank by someone who is seriously academically challenged, he went on to say. The judge, however, said that he would be failing in his public duty if he did not sentence Brown to jail time. People must learn that you cannot send out bomb hoaxes, because if you do, you will end up in prison, he ruled. He sentenced Brown to 6 months in a young offenders institution. Well, you know, when you think about it, the judge definitely has a point. After all, stupidity doesn't prevent punishment for a crime, because if it did, most prisons would be empty. I mean, really. I also could have made him the idiot of the day, but I didn't do that. That comes later in the program. Anyway, we have one more story to get to in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. If he stopped, Ray Tomlinson thought officials would have impounded my vehicle. They would have probably incarcerated me to do an investigation, and I had a 93-year-old woman in my car that I needed to get home. The part that made him nervous was a second woman in his car, age 31, who was dead. Yes. Tomlinson picked up his phone, looked at the internet, and as police relayed the story, concluded that by law, he had 48 hours to get the body to a morgue. He decided to take care of the matter after driving the two women in his van, the old one, his mother, and the dead one, his girlfriend, from Texas or Oklahoma, where he'd realized his girlfriend was dead, and he wanted to take them all the way back home to Michigan. Tomlinson, who is 62, said he cared too much for her to abandon the woman in a hospital far from home. When he met her a year earlier, she was homeless. Police said he hasn't been charged, at least yet, but he shouldn't have delayed seeking help. Sometimes laymen think people are dead when they aren't yet. Yeah. You know, if he had a cooler head, maybe her heart would still be as warm as his. And here's a hypothetical question, by the way. I know his mother was also in the car, but let's assume she wasn't, okay? Just for the sake of this story here. If you're driving with a dead body in your vehicle, can you use the carpool lane? Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? On Thursday, June 26th, during the World Gay Pride Week, 115 gay and lesbian couples got married in a mass ceremony in Toronto. Couples from around the world said I do in an interfaith ceremony that had integrated elements from 12 denominations. It also marked the first time a Sikh minister has presided over a gay marriage. That minister is Yogi Akal, and he joins us via Skype to Skype communications from Toronto. Hi, Yogi Akal.
Hello.
How you doing, sir?
Just peachy. Great to be here.
It's been a while since we've had a chance to talk. I was actually surprised. I'd seen a television news interview post-wedding and saw you and thought, oh, we've got to get in touch with you because we've had you on the show time and time again over the years talking numerology, but this is something entirely different. So how did you get involved in this mass wedding that took place last month?
Well, about a month ago, one of the folks from the Metropolitan Church contacted me in Toronto and asked me if I'd be interested in being part of the World Pride Interfaith Fair. And it sounded a little hokey at first, but I started looking into it, and it was a fascinating and, I think, brilliant idea. The idea was to bring people together of different faiths and have them represent that for the first time ever in Toronto and do that in a way that people could see, make it very visible, and support something called the Rainbow Railroad, which is one of the newer organizations that tries to help people in countries where homosexuality or any sort of orientation that is apart from the typical norm is punishable by death. People are in great danger. So they provide safe houses and try to actually go in and bring people to sanctuary. So from that fair, I was also asked to be an officiant at this mass wedding. I've been a minister for 23 years, but I've never been licensed to do a wedding. So I said, okay, that sounds great. And I hurried and became officially registered to be able to be a registered officiant at a wedding. And then had the great honor and privilege of, out of the 120 or so people who were getting married, I was given 12 to preside over. And it was, I have to say the day was not what I expected at all.
Well, what did you expect, and what did it turn out to be?
I think I expected 50% of what I saw, which was something very beautiful, lots of grandeur. It was a beautiful day. The Casa Loma in Toronto, where it was held, of course, is a very lovely spot. People were dressed up. It was a nice, big, beautiful party, and that's what I expected. What I didn't expect was the intimate, authentic, and powerful ceremonies that we did for each of the individual couples. We only had about 10 or 15 minutes per couple because there were so many. But the vows that people took and the seriousness that they held, the power that they brought to their individual weddings was so moving that you really couldn't question it ever again. I myself have questioned marriage. Said I want to support any kind of marriage that anybody wants, but who cares about marriage anyway? But after having seen this, I can see the value of marriage, not as a political thing, but as a personal and intimate experience. The vows that people took, the things they said to each other, their stories and histories, the willingness they had to do that in a short time in front of people, it was very moving and very penetrating. In my psyche.
Now, these couples, they were not just Canadians. They came from around the world, and there are still worldwide right now only 15 countries that allow same-sex marriage. So a lot of these couples come from countries that don't allow it, and a lot of these couples come from countries that persecute those who are even gay, as you mentioned earlier, so or lesbian or transgender or whatever the case may be. So it must have been an emotional moment to hear what some of these people had to say to each other when they were saying their vows in a place that allows them to do that.
Well, I would love to say that the political parallel aspect of this for people who were persecuted in different countries was very present, but every single couple had a story. Some of the, in my group of 12, there were two couples, men who were walking with canes. They'd been together 38 years, 39 years, 32 years. And this was the first time that they were taking the advantage of marriage. Their story was remarkable. A young couple, two women who had been together for 18 years and had 5 children. And yes, people from countries where either there was no possibility of being married, or there was a civil ceremony, but not a marriage.
Civil union.
Yeah. We forget sometimes that there are many places in the world where it's not just a matter of discrimination and homophobia, but it's murder. If you are in many countries, and unfortunately it's 2014, it's incredible that I have to say this out loud, that there are places in the world where to be gay, to be listed as an LGBTQ person, a lesbian, gay, bisexual, questioning person, will put your life in danger, will put your family's life in danger. These are things that we've never experienced here. Even in the worst homophobic decades of our experience in Canada, people were not legally sentenced to murder.
Right.
And there are places in the world where that still happens today. So this element is underneath the World Pride movement, and the interfaith community was very aware of that, and that's one of the reasons why we came together.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, it's the first time, to our knowledge, that a Sikh minister has presided over any kind of gay marriage. So has there been any pushback at all from within the Sikh community?
Not yet. I'm checking my email daily. I don't think there could be in Canada, because this is the law of the land here. So we have the duty to perform marriages if requested, and I don't see how anybody could refuse that. But I know that there are personal and cultural biases that people bring, as they do in any culture, in any faith, in any religion. That's just not mine.
When you got into this, as you said, it was a very lovely, moving situation, and they had asked you to be part of this. As I said, I saw you being interviewed on national television talking about what it was like to perform this ceremony and be part of it. What has the reaction, what has the media attention been like since you performed the wedding on that day, the 26th of June?
Well, there's been a lot of coverage of the wedding, even though it's been a while. Since the wedding, there have been more pictures and more videos coming up, because it really was a very beautiful event. And to have 120 people getting married, a mass wedding is news anyway, but a mass wedding that is same-sex and so well organized with such good imagery was important. One of the big deals for me was history being made, not just for the Toronto World Pride community of inviting people to be married in a ceremony that is interfaith, but for me to be the first Sikh to officiate at a same-sex wedding, that is history. And I didn't realize it really until I got to the wedding. And when it was my turn, each of the interfaith ministers gave a short blessing before the individual ceremony. And when I stood up to speak, I said, well, there are no Sikhs being married here today, but history is being made because a Sikh is officiating for the first time at same-sex weddings, and I'm not doing one but 12. And there was a spontaneous applause. And I was, again, very moved by this, because people weren't applauding me. They were just applauding progress. And it was really wonderful to have that spontaneous outpouring of support for that.
I've known you for quite a few years, and I've known you to always be a positive person. Having said that, your thoughts on what this means going ahead in the future, having been part of this event and seeing how this event has been received, how do you feel about what the future holds for gays and lesbians around the world?
Well, I think there's a larger issue here, which is human rights. The fact is that there are, again, places in the world where people are murdered for being gay or being considered to be gay or lesbian. There are places in the world where women are being murdered and sold into slavery. And it's 2014. We have to fight for human rights, unfortunately, still in our world. And I think I have a lot of hope for that, because as I've said in that interview, religion has done a lot of damage in this world. But there is possibility for interfaith communities to come together, take a stand, and maybe take some leadership in that fight for human rights, not just at home, but around the world, to give sanctuary for people who are in trouble, but also to fight for the rights of people everywhere in the world. The idea of whose orientation is what, this is silly. Religion should get out of the bedroom, as governments have in our own country, and let us move forward to much more important things in the world.
Yogi Akal, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's been a while. We have to talk to you again at some point. Maybe we have you back on the program talking about numerology. And that's another thing I wanted to ask very quickly. One last quick question. Since you are a numerologist, did the day hold anything for you as far as the number of June 26, 2014?
You know, I'm very embarrassed to say I never checked it. I never even thought to check it. I really separated out my position as a yogi and expert in the field of numerology and healing, and kept it very separate from my work as a community leader and an interfaith representative. I never thought of that. So you ask a very good question. Let me see. I'll figure it out right now. 32 and 14, 46. Well, it was a good day to be creative. a good day to get married, I'd say.
Well, good thing indeed. Again, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Yogi Akal from Toronto. You can check out his website at yogiakal.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0255, and you'll find the link.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to one of the stars of the movie Jersey Boys, plus the author of The Demeter Code, Russell Brooks, will be on the program as well. And of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And lots more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, I do so enjoy the wording of police or governmental reports. Please follow along with this one, okay? At around 7:40 p.m. on Thursday, police received a call from a woman at the Shropshire Arms pub in Northgate Street, Chester, reporting that a squirrel had climbed into her handbag and would not leave her alone. Those are the words of a spokesman for the Cheshire, England Constabulary, noting that it was a gray squirrel. Detective Constable, and it's important, by the way, that it's a gray squirrel in this story. Anyway, you'll see. Detective Constable Nigel Thake attended the incident and released the squirrel back into the wild. The spokesman was reminded that gray squirrels are an invading species which threaten the native red squirrel, and that therefore, per Section 9 of the Wildlife and Countryside Act, it is a criminal offense to release a gray squirrel into the wild. This means if you trap one, you are obliged to humanely dispatch it, said a spokesperson for Red Squirrels Northern England. Yes, that's actual group, which works to protect the native species. You must not let it go, as this act would be illegal. The police spokesman issued an update to his statement saying, I'm sure the squirrel in this case had managed to escape before a cage could be found. As an officer would say to an arrestee, basically, go tell it to the judge, is what he's saying here. Love the wording, though. Anyway, two vultures, the scavenging, meat-eating bird variety, have been hanging around K Street in Washington, D.C., a street well known for its office buildings full of lobbyists trying to influence legislation on Capitol Hill. Now, the Washington Post notes that such sightings are rare in the crowded city, adding that the birds are a political cartoon begging for a caption. A bird of prey expert says the two are likely a breeding pair, and once successful, they will tend to return to the same place, increasing the vulture population. Now, last year, about 200 vultures were spotted in the suburbs south of the city. Well, sure, of course. And it's going to take a few of them to dispose of the 535 turkeys that are already on Capitol Hill. But I digress. Okay, researchers for the Polish Academy of Sciences, writing recently in the Journal of Zoobiology, reported witnessing 28 acts of fellatio by two orphan male bears in a sanctuary in Croatia, the first ever report of bear fellatio, and the payoff from 116 hours of scientific observation over a six-year period. Now, in each case, the researchers wrote, the older male was the receiver, and the researchers speculated that the episodes were less sexual in nature than a reflection of the bear's early deprivation of maternal suckling. Okay, well, that explains the bears. So how do you explain the researchers who were watching this for 116 hours? Yeah, what's their motivation? Okay, here's a quote. Her husband had passed away and she had no one to turn to. That's what Steve Gosnell, a lawyer representing Catherine Goodwin, said. She was not thinking clearly, not thinking as she normally would. She was not aware of the seriousness of what she had done. 60-year-old Goodwin from Derbyshire, England, was accused of applying for a passport for her dead husband using a photo of a man she met in Spain. It was the second time she had allegedly made the attempt, and this time, officials also discovered her husband's two traffic tickets that he had received a year after his death. The speed camera tickets had been mailed to Goodwin's house, and she said her husband had been driving, resulting in a six-point penalty against his driver's license and £60. 60 pounds in fines, that's about $100 U.S., which, by the way, she paid. She pleaded guilty to two counts of perverting the course of justice and two of making fraudulent passport applications and was sentenced to 6 months in jail. Do you think she'll write to her husband while she's behind bars? And by the way, the dead only drive on the weekend and only if their name is Bernie. Anyway, we have time for one more story here in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And please, let me share with you a couple of first world stories that expertly describes businesses that prove we are going to hell in a designer handbasket. Daneson, an Ontario, this is story number one. Daneson, an Ontario purveyor of fine toothpicks, that's right, recently introduced for $35.99 artisanal toothpicks, that's per dozen, by the way, the price of $35.99, in single malt and other exotic flavors, for the discriminating dental raker. Now, the lemon-flavored picks are a bargain at only $19.99, yet are made of the same finest quality northern white birch, prepared according to exacting recipes. Okay. And item number two, the Skin by Molly Salon in Brooklyn, and by now perhaps with competitors, offers facials for the derriere, occasioned by a recent social media fascination with bum selfies. Molly's is the Shiny Hiney facial for $65 for a 30-minute treatment, important because she says acne can flare up anywhere. Okay. You know, I got nothing to add to that, but I will promise you that I'm going to try and track down those toothpick people because I think there's a story there to be told. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Actor Johnny Canizzaro is in the new Clint Eastwood-directed musical Jersey Boys. He plays the street-hustling Nick DeVito, one of the members who went on to form the doo-wop trio The Veritones, the predecessors to Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Johnny joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Johnny.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
So you got this important role, this neat role in a big Clint Eastwood film, Jersey Boys. First of all, how did you get the part?
Right. Well, it was kind of a long, arduous process. I had auditioned for the film over a year and a half ago, and that was before Clint, or Mr. Eastwood, rather, I should say, had signed on for it. It was being directed by Jon Favreau at that time. And I went in, I had a great audition with the casting director, and then the film got put into turnaround. So then when Mr. Eastwood picked it up, they had kept my tape, called me back in. I auditioned for several roles before finally being offered the role of Nick DeVito.
Okay, now you auditioned for several roles. Did all the roles you auditioned for, did they include singing parts as well?
Not all of them. There's a lot of smaller characters in the film that don't do any singing at all. But luckily for me, my role has a little bit of backup singing in one scene along with Frankie Valli. So that was very exciting.
Okay. Now, you alluded to Mr. Eastwood. So what was it like when he signed on and became your director?
You know, it was I still think about it sometimes, and I'm not even sure if I've accepted that it actually happened, because it was truly a dream come true. The man is such a legend, you know, in the entertainment world. So to be able to do a film that he's directing was, you know, it was very serendipitous, I guess you could say, because I'm an actual Jersey boy myself. I grew up in Central Jersey, and I've always been fascinated with mob movies and Broadway musicals, and so Jersey Boys encompassed all of that, you know, and to have Clint's name attached to it was just incredible.
Now, you know, again, you said he is a legend, he is an icon. He, in the 70s and 80s, kept Warner Brothers afloat, basically. So now you're doing this movie with him, but you also, if I'm not mistaken, weren't you a Warner Brothers tour guide?
Yeah, I was, actually. When I first moved out to Los Angeles in 2007, I worked as a tour guide giving, you know, guided tours of the back lot and the sound stages and whatnot. So it was very, it was just amazing to be able to go back and shoot on that same back lot that I used to tell people about every day, you know, for 8 hours a day. So it was very, I'll use the word serendipity, or not serendipity, it was kismet, I guess you could call it, you know.
Okay, thinking back to, you know, back in you know, the end of the last decade there, where you were working as a guy, did you ever think, you know, someday I'll be on this lot and I won't be giving tours?
I did. I always thought that, because that's the reason that I had applied there in the first place, because it was always my dream to be in feature films. So to have accomplished that, you know, at least begin to accomplish that, is it feels very good. And, you know, my family and everyone is just so, you know, proud, and we're all enjoying the ride right now.
You mentioned you're originally from Jersey. For that reason alone, how important is this particular story to you?
Yeah, it hits close to home because, like I was saying earlier, a lot of what the Four Seasons had, not the Four Seasons, but the guys who portray the Four Seasons, what they had gone through as kids growing up on the streets of Jersey, I can relate to very closely. So on that level, it was very personal, and I understand that kind of East Coast humor. I wasn't born in the same era, obviously, and times have changed quite a bit since then, but, you know, it's all the same. It all comes down to family and loyalty and all that kind of stuff that really makes those characters who they are.
Now, before it was even slated to become a motion picture, of course it was a Broadway play. Had you had the chance to see the play before talk of a movie came around?
I did, yeah. When it first came out, I had seen it on Broadway several times, and that's when I became a fan of John Lloyd Young, who plays Frankie in the film as well. And I thought it was incredible. And it's funny because friends of mine at that time had always said, you should audition for this show, you should be in it, you're perfect for it. And me, of course, never even thinking that would ever happen, I wound up being participating in the film. So it was very very strange how the whole thing happened, but I'm just so grateful for it.
It's funny because I was about to ask you, when you saw the play on Broadway, did you ever sit in the audience and think, you know, maybe I should have auditioned for that?
I auditioned for the stage show, definitely. You know, the thought never crossed my mind that they'd ever make a film out of it.
Okay. But you did think of auditioning for the stage show, is what I'm getting at.
Yes, yeah, several times I did. The problem was I was never confident enough in my vocal abilities, I guess, to follow through with it.
Now, in addition to this, Jersey Boys, which is now out in theaters, you recently worked on the TNT 40s gangster drama Mob City. What was that like?
Yeah, that was another amazing experience. I love pieces that tell stories from a different era. That was 1920s through the 1940s. And Frank Darabont from The Shawshank Redemption had directed that. And that was one of my first big TV things as well. So that experience was great. And it was just, you know, working with these people who have such an amazing reputation in this business, it's that the things that they teach you along the way is just, it's invaluable. You can't buy that kind of education. You know, so it was great. It really was.
It seems like you have a knack for period pieces going back to the middle of the last century.
Yeah, you could say that. You know, I don't know if it's my look or whatever, but hey, I don't mind it. I'm not complaining about that. I always say I was born in the wrong era anyway, you know.
What are you looking to do next?
I have an independent project that I go into production on toward the end of the summer. That's starring Anthony Geary from General Hospital. He's been on that show for over 35 years. Amazing, amazing actor. It's called The Obituary, and I can't talk too much about it, but it's going to be an independent film that's going to do the festival circuit and whatnot. So it's very exciting. It's about an older gentleman who is kind of nearing the end of his life, and he wants to make sure before he leaves this earth that the world remembers him the way that he wants them to. So he brings this local newspaper obituary writer over to write his own obituary the way that he wants it. And a lot of things happen. It's a very complicated story, but it's also very interesting to watch. So when it does come out, I hope people enjoy it.
Did you have a master plan when you first went out to Hollywood working on the Warner Brothers lot as a tour guide as to what your career trajectory would be? And if so, are you on schedule?
You know, I always said I'm going to give myself 10 years, because that's typically what most actors say. You know, if I can't make it in 10 years, then I'm going to give up. The thought of giving up never really crossed my mind, but this whole Jersey Boys thing coming about, it happened much sooner than I had expected, or it's starting to happen, at least, I should say. So, hey, listen, I'm not questioning anything. I'm just sort of going with it and see where the next, see what the future holds for me.
The story Jersey Boys, of course, is about Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons and the groups that became the Four Seasons. There are composite characters involved, but did you have the opportunity to meet any of the players from real life in making this movie?
Yeah, you know, Frankie Valli himself was on set several times during the shoot, and he was very, very kind and gracious and and giving with his, you know, with information about the experiences that happened when they were kids, you know, up to the creation of the Four Seasons and whatnot. So I did talk to the character of Tommy DeVito on the phone, and he also was very, very kind and gave me all kinds of great insight about himself and his brother Nick, who I portray. So I was very fortunate. You know, it's not always easy playing people, actual people from life, you know, because you have nothing to pull from. But the daughter of Nick DeVito had contacted me, and she gave me all kinds of pictures and audio files to review. So I knew a lot about her dad going into it. So it was nice to be able to, add that to my portrayal of the character.
And now, after you spent all this time on the set and you're doing press now, and I would assume you get together with some of the other actors and do the publicity tour, do you get to call Clint, or is it still Mr. Eastwood?
You know, I don't think I personally would ever call him Clint. I don't know if I would ever feel that comfortable with him, just as out of pure respect, you know, because he's accomplished so much of the kind of thing that I want to do, you know. So it's more of a respect thing for me. And but I don't know. I can't imagine that he would be upset if someone did call him Clint, because he seems like a very, very down-to-earth guy, and he was so kind to everyone every day.
Well, you've accomplished quite a bit yourself. The movie is Jersey Boys. And, Johnny, I thank you very, very much for taking a few moments to talk with us on the program.
Of course, and thank you guys so much for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Actor Johnny Canizzaro, one of the stars of the new film, Jersey Boys. You can check out his website at johnnycanizzaro.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0255, and you'll find the link to his site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. We just announced the finalists in our annual Wacky Warning Label contest, and after 17 years, they're just as outrageous as ever. One of the labels was found on a sheet of peel and stick decals. It warns, and I quote, "Decals are for decoration only, and will not prevent you from any bodily harm or injury." End of quote. You don't say. Another label was found on a box of ink toner for a printer. It warns, "Do not drink." Why do products come with so many common sense warning labels these days? Well, the answer is that in America, warning labels not only have to protect consumers from danger, they have to protect product makers from frivolous lawsuits too, and that can make for some pretty interesting labels. Let's be fair, these warnings are hilarious, but the cost of the lawsuits that makes these labels necessary is no laughing matter. To see these labels and the other finalists in our contest, and to find out how you can enter, visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Demeter Code. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But right now, a few more Stuff File news stories on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Michigan man who was claiming to be a resident of the planet Zoltron is facing a number of charges after he allegedly attacked a Muskegon County Sheriff's deputy's cruiser with a 4-foot metal pipe. Officers are investigating reports about a man breaking into homes when they came across Calquan Dion Burr, that's his name. On the dashboard video of the police cruiser, Burr can be seen charging the cruiser, jumping on the hood of the car, and attacking the windshield. Now, while the 20-year-old was being arrested, he told police that he would have, quote, tackled that car and could have crushed it if he wanted to, unquote. He also claimed that he was from the planet Zoltron and that his father sent him. Burr appeared to be on mind-altering drugs. You figure? And a witness said that he seemed drunk or high and was talking about seeing blue orbits. Burr was charged with malicious destruction of property, damaging police property, assault, and other charges. So, I guess he doesn't have diplomatic immunity from Zoltron then. Huh. Yeah. And finally, police received a call about a woman driving with unrestrained children in Allentown, Pennsylvania. An officer spotted 42-year-old Kathleen Ganicelli. She was fueling her car and stopped to ask if her kids were buckled up. Now, Kathleen allegedly jumped into her vehicle and drove off, snapping the fuel hose that was still inserted into her gas tank and dragging it along behind her. The officer pulled her over and says her three children, aged 2, 5, and 7, were not buckled or in any kind of car seat or child restraint of any kind, and charges will be made once results of a blood test are received. Now, are they testing for alcohol, drugs, or just the fact that, there's positive signs that this woman's an obliviate of some kind? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? Author Russell Brooks continues to write his spy novel series. He's the author of Pandora's Succession and Unsavory Delicacies, and now the third book in that series is just out. It's called The Demeter Code. Russell joins us right here from Montreal via Skype to Skype Communications. Hi, Russell.
Hello, good afternoon.
Now, this is, as I said, your third book in this particular series. When you first started writing, did you think that this was going to be a trilogy, if not more?
Well, I knew that there was going to be a sequel after having written Pandora's Succession. I honestly didn't know how many books would come out, but I knew that it would be a series.
Okay. Now, without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit about what The Demeter Code is all about? And first of all, also, what does the title mean?
Well, the Demeter Code, basically, as you notice, as you would have realized, Demeter is the goddess of the harvest. And it's just a way of branding the series so that it could be identifiable, like Pandora's Succession. And now you have the Demeter Code. Unsavory Delicacies is actually a trilogy. It's a short story anthology which features the main character from both Demeter and from Pandora, Ridley Fox. Now, that's basically where the where it comes into play. And when you read the book, you'll understand why I've used the name of a Greek deity in this case here.
Now, I know when you write these books, because I also see some of this stuff that you put out on Facebook and some of the questions that you ask, you do a lot of research to make sure you get the spy thriller correct.
Yes.
One of the things about the spy world is there's a lot of nefarious things going on. When you're sitting at home in your room writing in the dead of night all by yourself, do you ever get somewhat paranoid about some of the things you're actually creating?
Well, I do get paranoid every once in a while, and I can tell you when I first was writing Pandora's Succession, back in those days, MySpace used to be what Facebook is today, and I did get a friend request from someone who turned out to be a former CIA operative, who's now a best-selling New York Times best-selling author. His name is Barry Eisler. And when he contacted me to say that he was writing a book about spies in Tokyo, that really, really freaked me out, because Pandora's Succession actually takes place in Tokyo and it's about spies as well. And the first thing I did was jump up and I looked out my window to see if I was under some type of surveillance. I mean, I was really, really spooked at the coincidence about this. And of course, you know, there's always the thought that, you know, you may end up writing something, especially right now with revelation that the NSA has been spying on us and all that, that I may write something and it turns out to be something that may be under development or something that may catch their attention. And, you know, but so far, you know, I'm not so worried about any of that stuff anymore. Like, my main concern is that it's probably the biggest paranoia that any author would get, is that their work may end up being stolen or something like that. But in terms of what I write, it's just pure fiction. But I do a lot of research so that there is some level of reality in it.
Well, and again with collecting that research, you know, a lot of these days situations involve doing research by surfing the net. And as you search the net to find information to put within the pages of your stories, of your books, you might be Googling for certain things and checking for certain things that might draw red flags from other areas.
Well, there's always that risk there, but, you know, I don't have anything to hide, so I'm not worried about setting off any red flags with any government agency or anything of that sort there. But so that's basically it.
Now, you've come up with some very interesting ways to promote this book. Of course, you have a website. People can check out russellparkway.com. But you've done a sort of a reading of this.
Oh, yes. What I did in order to promote this story, I recorded the first three chapters, and I also hired a music composer down from Iowa to provide the music score for the narrative. And I broke up the three chapters into seven parts, and I released them as seven individual episodes. And one was each episode was released weekly. You can find the links to the episodes through my website at russellparkway.com. You'll either find them on YouTube or on SoundCloud. And the last episode was aired Monday of last week. So you can always catch up. It's online, so you can listen to each episode one after the next.
Now, the returning characters, they are Ridley Fox and Nita Paris. This is now, as you say, the third book that you've written that involves these characters. And I'm just wondering, as a writer, do you yourself get to discover new things about the characters that you didn't think of when you first started writing them?
Well, yes, of course. The more you write these characters, the more you learn things about them. Like, Take, for example, in Demeter, there's aspects of Dr. Paris's her childhood that come into play. Well, not come into play, but are brought up. Now, she's presented as a very, very brilliant scientist. She has a doctorate in biochemistry, and she's proper. She's conformative. Well, Ridley Fox, he's more of the rebel, and he's a former JTF-2 operative for and the JTF-2, for those of you who don't know, that's Canada's equivalent to the Navy SEALs down in the States. Now, although Paris is seen as this very brilliant scientist who assists Fox on this mission here, she wasn't that nice a person before. She used to be, when she was growing up in Barbados, she used to be involved in a lot of mischievous activity, and she'd get in trouble at school, and she broke into a house with her friends. Okay, I'm not going to go into further detail, but these are some of the things she used to do, and she turned out to be completely different. Whereas Ridley Fox, he's the man's man, a ladies' man. Well, he's an expert. He can speak 12 different languages right now. He's a ghost. He can infiltrate many organizations, many groups of people, and he'll go in and out. You'll never even know it. And yet, he has excellent combat skills. I mean, this is the guy you just don't want to mess around with, or the type of guy you don't want to upset and think that you can run away from, because he will find you and he will put a good slamming on you. But as it turns out, he wasn't always like that. He was, when he was growing up in school, he was the one who was picked on. He was the lanky weakling that always used to get beaten up. And these are the things that I never spoke about or wrote about in Pandora's Succession. These are the things I'm now discovering about them right now. So they're becoming more rounded, these characters, as time goes on.
Now, you mentioned the Canadian background with the SEALs, the Canadian version of the SEALs. You mentioned Nita's background being from Barbados. This also happens to be, both of these backgrounds happen to be yours. Barbadian background, Canadian. How much of you are in these characters or in these books?
How much of me is in these characters? Well, not too much. Maybe a little bit. I can say, like, I used to run track and field. I went to Indiana University on a track and field scholarship, and I was an all Big Ten. I was on the Canadian track team for the World University Games in 1999. I also competed for the Quebec team at the Jeux de la Francophonie when they were held in Madagascar in 1997, and again in Ottawa in 2001. Now, as you notice, Nita Paris, she used to run track and field as well, so she has some athletic skills. Now, as for Ridley Fox, my brother Randy, he was in the Canadian Army, so some of Ridley's background I borrowed from my brother. However, my brother wasn't in the Joint Task Force 2.
You say.
yeah. He wouldn't be able to say that, of course, but I figured, okay, look, I want to make Ridley a more powerful character, more suitable. I need a character who's who the public, the readers, would actually believe he can do these things, the things that he does. So he needs a type of stronger background than just being in the Army. He needs to be some type of former Special Forces operative. So that's the type of background I wanted to build for Ridley.
The book is called The Demeter Code. It's written by Russell Brooks. People can check out your website, which is russellparkway.com. Russell, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you very much, Peter.
Russell Brooks, author of The Demeter Code. You can check out his website at russellparkway.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0255, and you'll find the link. You'll also find links to amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Notorious San Diego tagger Francisco Canseco, age 18, was present in a downtown courtroom in June for a hearing on 31 misdemeanor paint vandalism charges and apparently could not contain his boredom. While waiting, as officials discovered only the next day, Canseco managed to tag numerous chairs in the courtroom, along with benches in the hallway, and vandalism of a courthouse, by the way, is a felony. Yeah. Now, why? Oh, why? Would someone who was already in court for a hearing on vandalism tag the very courtroom and the corridors outside of it? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0255. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0255. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Getting Jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up!